We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. T-Mobile.com.
Now, Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. Here's your host, KMOX Health Editor, Fred Bottomer.
Hi there, and welcome to this week's show. Thanks a lot for listening. Hope you're having a great weekend. Once again, this week, we have a lot of health stories to talk about, including new HPV vaccine recommendations, an update on measles in the United States, a closer look at PTSD, and are we still a fast food nation? But first, let's bring in our co-host, SLU Cares Dr. Nirav Patel. He's an infectious diseases specialist and chief medical officer at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Patel, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
I wanted to start this week's show talking about a rare illness with symptoms similar to polio. There's been an unusual rise this year in cases of acute flaccid myelitis. The Illinois Department of Public Health has received recent reports from healthcare providers of 9 sporadic clinically diagnosed cases of acute flaccid myelitis. That's in addition to dozens of cases seen throughout the rest of the United States. Here's CBS News chief medical correspondent Dr. John LaPook.
The rare, poorly understood polio-like illness attacks the body's nervous system. The CDC says there have been 38 confirmed cases this year through the end of September. 14 cases have been found in Colorado and 6 in Minnesota. Most of them have occurred in children.
Dr. Patel, what is acute flaccid myelitis?
Well, it's a catch-all phrase, in a sense, to describe what happens when you are get infected with a virus that causes these types of symptoms similar to polio. Polio and a large number of viruses are part of a family called enteroviruses, and they can cause neurological symptoms that occur because the virus either attacks or your body attacks some of your neurological cells, neurological function. And so it ends up causing the paralysis symptoms that you see with polio most historically and most classically, but also with these other viruses. And it was really poorly understood. We don't really know what's happening. We don't really know if it's the virus or if it's your body and the virus interacting together. But regardless, the effects can be devastating for these young children.
What are the symptoms we should be looking out for?
Well, the symptoms are very vague and can be hard to find. Most of the time, fevers, chills, diffuse body aches, pains, kid not eating well, not feeding well, or just feeling poorly. And then suddenly it can progress over time very quickly.
Is this just seen in children?
It can happen most frequently in children. It's most in this current outbreak, if you want to say, it's most associated with children. But there are, in the past, with polio and other polio-like illnesses, there's been outbreaks described in adults, too.
So what's the treatment?
Unfortunately, there's no real treatment. It's supportive care and then neurological rehabilitation. There's some experimental therapies, but all kinds of treatments have been tried without proven success.
And go over again, what might be the causes?
Well, they're viruses for the most part. So they're a whole family of different viruses called enteroviruses that can cause these things. The key steps that you can take to protect yourself are going to be to make sure that you wash your hands. Sick kids can easily transmit viruses to other children or to adults who may or may not be symptomatic. And then the adult can then transmit it to another child. And so the key is to make sure that you're washing your hands and ensuring you're using alcohol-based hand sanitizers to eradicate the virus.
Talking about hand sanitizer, there was a study this past week that asked the question, is hand sanitizer better than hand washing? Experts in this study say you shouldn't toss your soap just yet. What do you think about that, Dr. Patel?
I think there's a couple of important factors here. From a numbers perspective, meaning the ability of a particular cleaning product to reduce the amount of bacteria or viruses on your hand, Hand washing with soap and water for the full 30 seconds with a good amount of soapy suds reduces the amount of bacteria in your hands by about 90%, which is pretty good. Alcohol-based hand sanitizers can do about 99.9% of reduction in about 30 seconds or less with their effect. And so in my mind, the alcohol-based hand sanitizers are actually more effective because they go to 99.9%. But that being said, there's certain things that are better washed off by the mechanical action of the soap and the rinsing with the water. And then after a certain point, you can't just keep hand sanitizing without needing to wash your hands with soap and water as well. So it's important to understand the limitations of either one and then use both as appropriate. When you can, you don't have access to a sink, a water faucet to appropriately wash your hands, then using the alcohol-based hand sanitizer makes a lot of sense. If you need to, don't hesitate to wash your hands with soap and water as appropriate.
What do most doctors do before seeing patients?
The alcohol-based hand sanitizers are much better in the healthcare setting because they're quicker. They work right away within seconds. And the dispensers don't require a sink and faucet to use. And so they're all over the place. They also surprisingly cause less drying. The biggest challenge with the soap and water is that most people don't actually wash their hands and keep rubbing for the recommended duration. And so people kind of do a quick rinse. And my kids are guilty of this, right? They'll just do a quick rinse and say, I'm done. And that's really insufficient to achieve the 90% reduction.
As a patient, should you see your doctor before an exam sanitizing their hands?
Absolutely. I recommend that to all my patients. And it's challenging because you may not want to, you may feel a little uncomfortable to question your healthcare provider. But I think the expectation is hand hygiene is a critical patient safety function, and you want to make sure that you're safe. And so it's okay to ask your healthcare provider if they wash their hands or to demonstrate it when they enter the room. And I try to do that right in front of the patient. I walk in and I have my I do the hand sanitizer right as I'm introducing myself and saying hello.
Let's talk just a little bit about breast cancer. There's a new study out that says there's a new link between losing weight and reducing the risk of breast cancer.
A study in the journal Cancer covering more than 60,000 women finds those who lost weight after menopause were less likely to develop invasive breast cancer than women who maintained or gained weight. Researchers say while it's been known that obesity is a risk factor for older women developing breast cancer, it wasn't known if losing weight could affect risk. About a third of postmenopausal women in the U.S. are obese.
How important is weight when it comes to breast cancer risk?
I think it's very challenging to estimate what the actual impact of any one of these things is, but I think it makes sense at a general level. Patients are obese, they have a lot more inflammatory markers in their bloodstream, and we've clearly seen the link between improved cardiovascular health and obesity, and a large portion of that is actually not related to the things that you and I might think about, which is the heart attacks or the strokes, but is related to the damage done to blood vessels and then what's called inflammation as those blood vessels try to repair themselves. And that chronic state of always having to repair yourself from the cholesterol damage is an important factor in the development of heart disease. And similarly, that inflammation is associated with obesity and being overweight. And so if that inflammation is always going on, that can predispose you to continuous injury and then potentially cancer. So it makes a lot of sense. I think that we still need some more research identifying the links, but being healthy and reducing weight will help with your cardiovascular health, but especially for women that have increased risks of breast cancer with family history, things like that, they cannot control, weight is something that they can control.
We're talking with SLU Cares Dr. Nirav Patel. He's an infectious diseases specialist and the chief medical officer at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Wanted to talk to you about a new study on standing at work. There's been substantial research on the health dangers of sitting at work. But what are the benefits of working while standing?
A British study suggests that working at so-called sit-stand-height-adjustable desks improves performance, physical problems, and mental outlook. In the research published in the British Medical Journal, around 150 sedentary health service staff were assessed across 12 months. At the start, the average sitting time was nearly 10 hours a day. A year later, the group using the sit-stand desks cut that to less than an hour and a half. They report improved musculoskeletal problems, less anxiety, and a better quality of life. Larry Miller, CBS News, London.
Dr. Patel, we have a couple of those desks here at work that will rise to let you stand to do your work. Should we be standing more than sitting?
I think it makes a lot of sense. I mean, in general, you know, at work, you're sitting. It's not always the case that you might have the best ergonomics. I kind of slouch when I'm sitting in my chair, and it then facilitates a poor posture, perhaps back problems. Furthermore, the standing part, you're kind of always shuffling in a little small amounts, and that really can strengthen your core muscles, which are important for posture and overall health. So from my perspective, it makes a lot of sense. This is great to see the research being done because, it made sense. It's really nice to see that research help support that.
I'm a big sloucher, too. Dr. Patel, thanks a lot for joining us. We'll see you back here again at the end of the show for your health tip of the week.
Perfect. Thank you.
SLU Care's Dr. Neera Patel is the Chief Medical Officer at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. He's also an infectious diseases specialist. When we come back, we'll talk about the measles. Is there really an outbreak in America? You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. How worried should we be about the measles? I've heard a lot of stories on the news lately about a measles outbreak nationwide. Wanted to talk about that with SLU Care pediatrician Dr. Ken Haller. He's a pediatrician at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Dr. Haller, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
What's the story?
Well, the thing is that there are occasionally these breakouts of measles. What's interesting is that measles has officially been eradicated from the United States, which means that the outbreaks that occur always occur because they're brought in from somewhere else. This may be people have visited another country where immunization policy is not as strict as it is in the United States. And so what happens is someone who's unimmunized goes to somewhere in Europe, for example, picks up the measles, comes back here, and then spreads it to other children and sometimes adults in their community. We have been lucky in that when these outbreaks occur, they have been self-limited, meaning that what happens is the infection spreads to a number of people. Those people get sick. They may spread to other people, but eventually the outbreak burns out and it doesn't become reestablished in the United States as an ongoing problem. Now, the reason for that is because the United States has actually been pretty proactive about having a pretty strict vaccination policy. This is not true in a lot of European countries, interestingly enough. And what's happened over there is that in a lot of these European countries, measles is still fairly common, and a lot of kids end up getting very sick from it. Some kids die of it, and that is where the outbreaks come from. My concern is that enough people are not immunizing their kids that we might start getting to a point where we have a critical mass of unimmunized children, so that if measles does get introduced into a community, that may be the spark to spread from one immunized kid to another that could allow measles to reestablish itself in the United States. That's something that nobody wants. I am in my 60s, and I remember having measles when I was in third grade. It was absolutely horrific. I couldn't do anything for 2 weeks. I was sick as a dog. I had a hard time seeing. I had a hard time swallowing. I'm surprised I didn't end up in the hospital and needing IV fluids. Back in those days, in the 1960s, as many as 1 million children a year would end up catching the measles, and over 1,000 of them would die. We are very lucky that we don't see those sorts of numbers anymore. We see numbers of measles cases in the hundreds. That's still too many, because that is just enough of a spark that if it spreads to unimmunized communities and unimmunized groups of kids. And if those percentages get large enough, it can reestablish itself, and then we would have a really hard time getting rid of it.
So it seems to me like you're talking about something called herd immunity. Is that right. What's so important?
Right, right. So here, there are a couple of things about measles. One is the vaccine. We give the vaccine at about a year of age, and then a second dose at 4 years of age. If people get it at a year of age, it's the percentage of kids who will actually develop an effective immune response is in the low 90s, about 92 to 93%. If everyone gets re-immunized at age 4, then the level of immunity rises to the high 90s, about 97, 98%. That means that there will still be two out of 100 kids who, even if they get vaccinated, will not have an immune response if they run into measles. But if 98 out of 100 people are immune to it, it's very unlikely that those two kids would run into someone who has measles and then get sick with it. What happens is each time, for each percentage that we drop in terms of effective immunity, the ability of an infectious disease to reestablish itself increases geometrically. It's not arithmetically, it's geometrically. So it becomes one of these curves that starts spiking up much, much more quickly than you would expect, just going from, say, 98% to 97% to 93% to 90%. When you have 10 out of 100 kids who are not immune to say, measles, and one of them gets sick, there's a much greater chance that the other 9 will get sick and then spread it to the next group of 10 out of 100, the next group of 10 out of 100. So there are reasons why we give these vaccines. We give these vaccines to kids because these are diseases that can kill them. And I'm old enough that I have seen kids with every single disease we vaccinate against. I've even known adults in my life who had polio as a child, so I know how bad these diseases can get. There are a lot of younger people and a lot of younger parents who haven't seen them. They don't know how bad they are. And they hear these stories about vaccines and how awful they are. And to be a parent and be scared for your child's safety is normal and natural and healthy. And if someone brings these concerns to me, I'm very glad to hear it. What I talk to parents about at that point is not that there's anything wrong with being scared for your child's safety, but if you're going to be scared for your child's safety, be scared of the appropriate thing, which is these diseases. The vaccines will help to keep your kids healthy, will help to keep your kids from getting diseases that are potentially life-threatening or life-limiting in the long term. And measles is one of those that we have done a really good job of making very, very, very uncommon, and we'd like to keep it that way.
What are the symptoms of measles?
Well, the symptoms of measles generally involve a high fever, sore throat, just generally feeling lousy. It can involve headaches and abdominal pain. It can also involve problems with vision. Sometimes people will be sensitive to light, and then eventually the rash will break out. People also have what are called Koplik spots. Those are these little blue spots inside the roof of the mouth. So it can look like a lot of other viral illnesses. It's just a much, much worse one. And when kids get it, it tends to last 7 to 14 days, and kids are pretty sick that whole time. And because they have so much of a problem with sore throat, it can be really difficult to swallow, and a lot of these kids end up getting dehydrated and end up in the hospital needing IV fluids. It can also cause enough respiratory symptoms that that secondary problems can occur with breathing. It can invade the central nervous system. So it is a particularly bad virus. The other thing about measles virus that we have to keep in mind, it is probably the most contagious virus that we know of. If someone in a room has it and sneezes and it goes around the room, pretty much anyone in that room will pick up that virus and may get sick with it if they're susceptible to it. That's why vaccination is so important.
Dr. Haller, thanks for joining us. SLU Cares' Dr. Ken Haller is a pediatrician at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. When we come back, we'll find out if America is still a fast food nation. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. When was the last time you stopped for a slice of pizza or a burger? A new study confirms we're a fast food society.
In its first ever such analysis of adult eating habits, the CDC has found 1 in 3 of us eat fast food on any given day. That's about 85 million Americans, all tucking into fatty, salty, sugary, artery-clogging, diabetes-inducing processed foods. Women tuck in as often as men. Higher-income families eat fast food more often than lower-income families. And African-Americans are the biggest consumers. Vicki Barker, CBS News.
Here to talk more about that study with us is Sheetal Mehta. She's a clinical dietitian with SSM Health St. Joseph's Hospital in St. Charles. Sheetal, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
What's the impact of fast food on our health?
Fast food, you know, when people have consumed fast food too often for convenience, it has been associated with increased risk of obesity, which also increases risk for type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, certain types of cancer. And mostly it's because fast food tends to be higher in calories, fat, salt, and sugar.
So if we're eating too much of that on a regular diet, it's really bad.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. And I think the new study that they just, or the report, I would say, that came out said that almost 40% of people are, like a third of the population eats fast food on a given day.
So what should we be eating? What makes up a healthy diet?
You know, a healthy diet should should have fruits, vegetables, whole grains. Proteins and fats should be like a side portion of it, not the main portion of it. It should be more wholesome. It should be more fresh rather than the ones that's processed. And I know it's a lot of the people who do eat fast food are working population, more convenience sake, that we end up eating. And there are always good ways of doing some convenience food ahead of time.
Tell us about that. What can you do?
You always can plan maybe a couple of hours in a week to figure out some basic groceries, like buy some least processed meats or deli meats that you can use to make some sandwiches on whole grain bread. You always can buy some cut up fresh fruit and maybe some vegetables, like in small little packs, or make a big pot of homemade soup on the weekend, which doesn't take a whole lot. And so if you do a little bit of planning, which takes typically on an average about 2 to 4 hours, depends on how extensive you want to go, and that could last you for the whole week. Have your meals ready to go, and you can take it while you're in a hurry or have too much packed in a day.
As a clinical dietitian, is all fast food bad, or are there certain types of fast food that we should really stay away from?
So reality is that these days fast food industry has come up with some healthier options. If you look at the menu, you know, you'll find at least 2 or 3 healthy food options at every fast food chain restaurant. But you have to be specific. Like if you go to McDonald's or Burger King, they always have salad with grilled chicken, or they may have grilled chicken on a bun or just a regular hamburger. As long as you are careful on the sides, condiments, and the portion size, I think sometimes you can use fast food as a way of convenience.
Do you think enough people look at the menu first and see the calorie count or see what's inside the meals that they're buying?
I think from this report, which also is kind of limited on how much we can rely on it, kind of indicates maybe people are not looking at it as closely. But I personally, in the last 5 years, being a clinical dietitian working in an outpatient practice, I think people have become a little bit more educated. Food industry is making more people aware of what the calorie, fat, sodium, sugar content is. So if people do choose to make healthier choices, they have the tools to do it. And it is very readily available.
Okay, so give us some last-minute tips again on how we can eliminate fast food from our diet.
Again, plan your meals ahead of time. So if you have a busy day, you can pack some easy things. Wraps are very easy to do as long as you have some meat and vegetables chopped up and cut up and ready to go. You always have, like, you can buy bags of salads that you can kind of portion it out in small Tupperware container and add your favorite protein in it, and then always have a dressing on the side. You always can look into some healthier snacks, which often people go through drive-thru or Quick Trip to pick up some snack things. So carry fruit or small healthy granola bars or nuts as an option for snack when you are on the go.
Thanks a lot for joining us. Great information. Appreciate it.
All right. Well, you're welcome.
Sheetal Mehta is a clinical dietitian with SSM Health St. Joseph Hospital in St. Charles. Coming up, we'll talk about some new recommendations for the HPV vaccine. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. The Food and Drug Administration has approved the use of a human papillomavirus called Gardasil 9 for men and women between the ages of 27 and 45. CBS News Chief Medical Correspondent Dr. John LaPook.
The FDA is saying we are approving the use of Gardasil for people who are 27 through 45. It's based on some further studies they've done that show that it's effective and safe. There are always side effects to any vaccine, but the benefits of giving Gardasil outweigh any risks.
Here to talk more about that is Dr. Kristen Wheeler. She's an OBGYN with SSM Health DePaul. Dr. Wheeler, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So tell me about this new announcement from the FDA. What is it saying?
So previously, the vaccine was approved up until age 26. And so this is basically just extending it and saying that for individuals not previously vaccinated between the ages of 27 and 45, it is acceptable and it would be effective for HPV prevention to go ahead and vaccinate those people.
What is the human papillomavirus?
Great question. So it's a DNA virus, much like herpes or the flu or any other virus, but this one has about 200 strains, and some strains can kind of take up residence in different areas of the body and predispose to cancer. It can also lead to genital warts and a very huge burden of disease.
Whom does it affect the most?
I would say predominantly women. Men are susceptible, particularly to cancers of the mouth and throat, as well as the anogenital area. But far and away, the most common thing would be women with abnormal pap smears, which can progress to cervical cancer.
Up until now, we heard a lot about the HPV vaccine for use in preteens up to the age of 26. Why the need there?
That is the highest rate of sexual activity, kind of newly sexually active, highest rate of acquisition of the virus. Most teenagers we're seeing them become active between ages of 15 and 25. So the goal would be to vaccinate prior to that, which is why we've started targeting as early as age 9, but ideally around 11 to 12.
What does the vaccine do?
So a vaccine is made with a little particle that typically is carried on the outside of the virus, and whenever it's injected, it causes the body to make an immune response so that if the body does encounter the real virus, it knows how to fight it off and keep it from actually progressing to affect your tissues.
How successful is it?
Oh, it's been phenomenal. The impact of the vaccine is huge. There is a dramatic decrease in abnormal pap smears and cervical cancer incidence since the vaccine has been around. Even for those who are unvaccinated, there's herd immunity. So we're really seeing a drop in the effects that it can cause.
So tell me again why the age limit has been increased for this vaccine.
So the vaccine's been around since about 2006 or so, and since it came to market, they have extended the research and been looking at it in older individuals and have found that there is an 88% prevention rate for HPV in those potentially not previously exposed who went on to have the vaccine. And so what we previously thought is, oh, well, by the age of 27 or so, most people have typically been exposed to the virus and so unlikely to benefit. But we're really starting to think in terms of now, well, there may be people with different situations who are either not having sexual activity up until that time or are acquiring new partners and new risk factors for HPV where they previously may not have had it. And so we need to just be a little bit more open-minded about those who could benefit from it.
We're talking with OBGYN Dr. Kristen Wheeler at SSM Health DePaul. As an OBGYN, is this a big deal for you?
Absolutely. And it's already, even in the last week, really impacted. I'm already having discussions with patients who were previously asking for the vaccine, but, you know, past the age limit, and, you know, now they're coming back and wanting it. What we don't know yet is really how it's going to impact insurance. My hope is that with the new guideline, insurance will jump on and extend that for patients, but they may be waiting to see what the CDC says.
How many doses do you need to get?
So it really depends on the age at which it's initiated. Typically, we say if you start the vaccine series less than age 15, you only need two. Beyond that, it would be three doses. I always tell my patients one now, one in 2 months, and then one 4 months after that.
Are there any drawbacks to getting the vaccine? Any side effects?
You might experience a little bit of kind of injection site redness, pain, or swelling. But beyond that, there are no long-term effects or other issues.
Sounds like the flu vaccine then.
Exactly, which everyone should also get.
Dr. Wheeler, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Kristen Wheeler is an OBGYN with SSM Health DePaul. Thanks, Dr. Wheeler.
Thank you.
Switching gears just a bit, I wanted to talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. A few weeks ago, former Missouri Secretary of State Jason Kander, an Afghanistan war veteran, announced he would not seek the office of mayor of Kansas City because he has PTSD. Kander writes, after 11 years of trying to outrun depression and PTSD symptoms, he's finally concluded that it's faster than he is. He says he has to stop running, turn around, and confront it. Here to talk about that is Anthony Bass. He's the director of SSM Health Treatment and Recovery at St. Joseph's Hospital in St. Charles. Anthony, how common is Jason Kander's story?
It's pretty common. I think that most of the time what happens is that it goes unnoticed by the average person until something happens where it's up close and personal, or that it's in the media, or they hear about it on television or something like that. But with everything that's going on in the world and everything that first responders are experiencing, being a police officer or a firefighter who's exposed to a lot of trauma, or individuals that have been in the military that's been exposed to a lot of trauma, and or the average citizen that's exposed to trauma in the community in reference to shootings or a tragic car accident or some of the more natural disasters that we experience, like flooding or earthquake and things like that, often experience the PTSD symptoms, or they will discover that they have the symptoms after having continuous bouts of depression and anxiety and things like that. Sometimes it's a process, and it's a process that some individuals live with and struggle with until it worsens, and or they find themselves trying to medicate the symptoms of PTSD with drugs or alcohol, and or, again, they try to get in other risky behaviors to experience pleasure when they are just kind of overwhelmed with being depressed and down for a significant amount of time. And in the worst case scenarios, they can have unwanted memories or nightmares and flashbacks and things like that that will eventually force them into a situation where they have to get treatment or realize that they just can't function without help.
Tony, tell me about the symptoms of PTSD. What should people be looking for?
Normally, there are multiple different types of symptoms. Individuals that seem to be plagued by ongoing nightmares about traumatic events or experiencing flashbacks and just having some emotional distress about recurrent thoughts of a traumatic event or some pretty serious symptoms. Another symptom, or should I say cluster of symptoms, would be changes in their sleep patterns, inability to concentrate, just being nervous in general, and having a lot of fidgeting and or just distracted by things associated with a trauma, individuals that appear to be more irritable or aggressive, and or in some cases, some individuals get involved with risky or destructive behaviors, and they may be more easily startled or having some difficulty concentrating and things like that.
Do you think coming forward like this by Jason Kander can help others that have PTSD but aren't getting help?
Definitely. I think that him being a high-profile person allows other individuals that may be suffering in silence to understand that they can get past the stigma or the shame and guilt associated with mental illness and step up and get some help.
Can PTSD only be treated or can it be cured?
Well, it can be cured and or it can be treated. For some individuals, it's a lifelong struggle. For other individuals, with the appropriate treatment, they can go on and lead a normal, productive life. But that's not to say that they would not ever be triggered again by a unpleasant event or a memory of a song or a television commercial and things like that. The symptoms may not be as intrusive or as serious, but it's really difficult to call when a person may or may not re-experience symptoms associated with PTSD.
So what's your word of advice to people who served in the military or they were first responders and they think they may have PTSD?
I would suggest that they follow up with their private physicians. If they're in the military, they can follow up with the VA and try and find a support group or get some professional help through their insurance provider or some of the other treatment centers that are out there, but not sit back and suffer in silence and feel that it's okay and that it's safe to speak with family, friends, and or to reach out to the professionals and get help and not try to go it alone.
Good deal. Anthony, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me on.
Anthony Bass is the director of SSM Health Treatment and Recovery at St. Joseph Hospital in St. Charles. Well, we've come to that point in the show where we get our health tip for the week. Joining us once again is our co-host, SLU Cares Dr. Nirav Patel. He's the chief medical officer at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. He's also an infectious diseases specialist. Dr. Patel, what's your health tip for the week?
Well, we've heard this story of devastating paralysis in children in multiple states, and that's most frequently associated with a virus, enteroviruses that can cause these types of things. And then we've also talked about hand washing and whether hand washing or hand sanitizers are better. And I think the key point here is to do something, either hand sanitizer or hand wash, both as appropriate as you go about your daily routines. The key is to try to integrate that hand sanitizing and hand washing so that you protect yourself and your family.
Dr. Patel, thanks again.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week for another edition of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.